You're listening to 98.7 Your Story Counts with Nan and Simone. How are you, Nan?
I'm very good.
That's good. We're heading for a top of 12 degrees today.
That sounded really exciting at the beginning. We're heading for a top of 12.
Yeah, 12. How was your weekend?
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic, actually. So busy.
Yeah.
I've got a little cheerleader.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was all about, you know, I don't know, chasing my brothers around with BMXs.
Yeah.
And which led into sort of triathlons, which meant, you know, swimming, cycling, running every day.
Yeah.
And of course, netball and softball, which had pretty clear rules, I think.
Mm.
Yeah. But now I'm in the world of cheerleading.
Wow.
Oh, and it is not what you think. There's no pom-poms.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
I like a good pom-pom.
Yeah. No, it's nothing like those American movies. It's so misunderstood and it's just huge.
So does she practice on you where she tosses you up in the air and tries to catch you?
Or? I tell you, she would if I gave her half a chance.
Right, okay.
She absolutely would.
So she just practices on Charlie? Yeah. Have a leaking Charles?
Yeah, she does. How did you know?
Oh. Just call me intuitive.
That's it. Yeah, that's right. No, it's an incredible sport. We talk about football, don't we?
Yeah.
And we talk about, you know, when we were younger, the commitment of parents helping us get to sports events. Well, this cheerleading is the same.
Mm.
I mean, she had to be at Knox at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
Now, of course, if your kid does footy or something like that, they just throw on a pair of shorts and a top.
Yeah.
But no, by the time we get there at 7, we've Hair had makeup? To do the whole thing. Yeah. And I can't say that's my forte.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Emmy's absolutely brilliant at makeup now.
Yeah, okay.
She had to be.
Yep.
But hairs or tees, you got the bow in the, you know, in the hair, and you've also got the full costume, the spray tan, the whole thing. So and they love it. They absolutely love it. 4,000 kids were there. There was already a bit of congestion on Eastlink at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to Knox. But I guess the point about it is that I guess Aussie kids these days, you know, they love the gymnastics.
Yeah.
Always did. But for us, by the time we were 12, our bodies were sort of, you know, not, well, if you weren't wiry, you know, and petite, then that was it. That was the end of your sort of, you know, gymnastic days.
Yep, change direction.
And yeah, that's right, change direction. Whereas cheerleading is allowing all these Aussie kids to do that sort of floor work.
Mm.
And if you put that in with dance, you know, aerobics and Cirque du Soleil, where, you know, kids are being thrown in the air and caught by their own best friend. You know, they just think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So nationals get something like 10,000 little athletes running around.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Plus parents.
Mm.
It's just huge.
Yeah.
So she loved it. And, of course, being a part of Outlaws, which is an amazing club just down here, they won.
That's
so I had a very happy little cheerleader for the rest of the afternoon. Thank God. Could have been a different afternoon.
That's right.
Yeah, so great fun. But anyway, I mean, that was our childhood. But that was that's their childhood, but our childhood was very different. And that's why we want the wonderful Karen Livingstone to talk to us today.
Yes, the Well Activist, awarded advocate and health entrepreneur is here in studio.
Woo-hoo.
Welcome, Karen.
How are you?
Very well. Very well.
Yeah. So thanks for coming down so early for us. You know, I hope you've had your coffee because we've got a bit to get through today. You've got one heck of a story to tell.
I know. Very inspirational.
Yeah.
So we're just talking about childhood. So what was it like growing up for you?
Well, you know, for us, I came from a swimming family. So we had three children. My brother was older. My sister was younger. We all swam. And
wow.
So we were very regimented with regards to that.
Yeah.
Our community was very much the swimming community. My sister, Nicole, was a three-time Olympian. So there was a lot of, a lot of team effort at home to make sure that she was able to have all the conditions right for her to swim.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was also a state finalist. Me, on the other hand, apparently I was very good at social.
You were the community.
I was the glue bringing it all together.
Yeah, we heard about you.
That's right, exactly. We need the glue. The glue's so important.
It is very important. As a family, there were a lot of sacrifices that were made to ensure that Nicole had opportunity. Certainly from mum and dad's perspective, you know, there was a lot of, you know, you were talking about 10,000 kids. I mean, it is expensive to put these kids through these kind of sports.
Absolutely.
And it was in our day as well. Mm. It was a sacrifice from mum and dad's perspective to have three kids in swimming.
So did you sort of have any other interest apart from swimming, or did you feel like you just had to go with the swimming because everyone was swimming?
Yeah, most of my friends were actually swimming. Okay. So, you know, it would be that you would be hanging out on the weekends. Mm-hmm. I think the really interesting thing was that I did try horse riding.
Yeah.
That didn't particularly work.
Yeah.
I ended up having a horse riding accident at 13 and crushed two vertebrae in my back. So that was the end of that career.
Okay. Yeah.
Although my family were all horse trainers and jockeys. So, yeah. And I believe you've had one of my cousins on board, and that being
fantastic
Rebecca Waymer.
Yes. Yeah. We love her. She's gorgeous. Yeah. She's fantastic. Yeah.
I also played netball, played softball as well at school, and athletics. I was a sprinter.
Wow.
In school, not anything outside of that. But it was really interesting because, you know, you were saying that kids give up gymnastics. Some of us weren't able to do that because we weren't allowed. I was never allowed to roller skate or ice skate.
Oh, really?
Because, you know, apparently I was uncoordinated until I got into the pool, and then I was very coordinated. But, you know, if
there's
I was...
There's nowhere to fall.
No, exactly. But if I injured myself, you know, then obviously I wouldn't be able to make swim meets.
Okay.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So, So, it was a good upbringing. I think certainly you make a lot of connections and networks in those days. And certainly I know a lot of people that used to swim now in my network, and or connection through connection through connection that leads you back to that time, which is really nice.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
That's a really good question, actually.
Well, actually, the really interesting thing is that in year 12, I actually wanted to be a lobbyist.
Wow, that's interesting.
Well, you sort PR lobbyist.
Yeah, you sort of fulfilled that in a way.
I know, without going to uni, so probably saved some money that way.
And some time.
And some time, absolutely.
So what was your passion for that, do you think?
I think it probably stems back to fairness and justice.
Yeah.
I think I've always had that. I'm Liberan, so
you need that balance,
the scales. But yeah, no, I think I've always felt really, I guess, confronted by injustice. Mm-hmm. So that everything that I've done in my life as an adult has actually been around trying to balance that and try to make things better for people in their lives.
Well, we need more people like you in the world, don't we?
We so do, yeah.
Thank you, Simone.
Fantastic. Well, let's start with one of the songs, hey, that you've chosen. This is Lighthouse, Family. Very appropriate. Hi. Yeah, so it must be, I have to say, I can imagine for your parents just so intense. It's the same as cheerleading in the way that you are, you know, working so hard for your kids to get them there with it financially as well as for time. Mm. But it's only, you know, for swimming is for a matter of seconds, isn't it?
It is, I guess. And in the day that we swam, it was very much about the individual, not so much the team.
Yeah.
I guess as the Australian swimming team developed, it became more about what the team could actually the success of swimming teams, but certainly
Lumps
when we swam,
it,
it was very much about the individual and what they could achieve.
Okay,
so it was actually nice to see it come together in more of a team working.
Yeah, and so when you got out of school, then what happened?
I actually went into logistics.
Oh, did you logistics?
I know, that sounds really boring, doesn't it? Logistics. I actually went to work for what was then May Nicholas, which was eventually taken over by Toll, and I'm sure that everyone's seen Toll trucks on the on the road.
Yeah.
So I did that until I was pregnant. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was 11 years in logistics.
Wow.
Hmm.
And then you met your husband.
I did. It probably connected. I was actually looking after major accounts for the organisation that I worked for.
Yeah.
And one of my clients was getting married, and she actually invited me to her hen's night.
Okay.
And I said, okay, fine. And they were actually coming from the outer suburbs of Melbourne, and I was living in Carlton. And I actually said, well, you know, you can pick me up on the way. And I gave her my address, and I sat and I waited and I waited, and it seemed like an hour and a half that after they were supposed to pick me up, and I got this phone call from this guy saying, hey, we actually went to the address, but we went to Brunswick, not Carlton, and we're already at the venue. Can you jump in a cab? I thought, well, that's pretty presumptuous of him. Okay. So my housemate said, look, I'll drop you in there. So I actually went in to this nightclub, and the hen was there, and I actually said to her, hey, and she turned to this guy who, and she said to him, hey, David, look, this is Karen. This is who we were supposed to pick up.
Yeah.
And very smoothly said, well, if I hadn't known she was that good looking, I would have made sure we picked her up.
And the rest was history,
the
really.
The rest was 18 years of history, yeah.
Wow.
It was, yeah, that's pretty much how it started. I mean, apart from the fact that I got horribly drunk that night and can't really remember much about it, but he did remember my address.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, because he remembered that he was where he was actually meant to pick me up from, not the wrong address. But I then subsequently got a letter from him the following week that was two sheets of paper, all with words starting with A. And at the end of it, instead of David, it was Avid and a phone number. And I had no idea where this letter came from or who this person was, and I was freaking out. And I made my housemate actually ring to find out who it was. And she said, did you meet some comic on the weekend? And I said, oh, yes, I did actually. So 2.5 hours later, we were on the phone, and then we caught up the following week for dinner, which halfway through the night he told me it was his birthday.
Oh.
So that was our first date.
And you gave him a birthday present.
Yeah. Yes, I did. I had dinner with him, Simone.
It was a very long dinner.
That's
very long dinner.
But we did. We moved in. He moved into the house maybe 6 weeks later.
When you know, you just know, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And it was a bit like that. Was it like love at first sight?
It was intrigue at first sight,
yeah.
I think. He was different to anything I had ever been attracted to.
Yeah.
He was really knowledgeable. I have a really great passion for general knowledge, and he was well on top of that. And also he was actually older. And he was actually had the salt and pepper hair.
Which I love.
Which is very sexy.
Yeah, it is
very
sexy.
Very mystique.
Very, definitely. And a hint of experience in there as well. So, yeah, we connected.
Yeah.
Which was pretty amazing.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
That was High Lighthouse Family. You're listening to 98.7 Your Story Counts with Nan and Simone. And in the studio we have the gorgeous, talented Karen Livingstone, the well activist, awarded advocate and health entrepreneur. Now, Karen, Dave had a pretty unique profession.
He did. He was actually a stand-up comic.
Okay.
So he actually entertained people on stage for a profession, which is not an easy thing to do to make people laugh. And there were, particularly early in his early days, there were a number of gigs that didn't quite go according to plan.
Right.
But he learned a lot from that. And and certainly Dave was part of the Melbourne comedy scene and brought it to the Australian comedy scene throughout his career and very well respected. I think that was a very strong piece for him.
Mm. So when you were at home, was he entertaining you? Was he one of a totally different personality?
Oh, Simone, so many people have asked me that. You know, oh, gee, it must be so fun living at home with a comedian.
Probably not.
No, it's not. No, I mean, you know, if you think about comics and what they talk about on stage, I think a lot of them have actually had challenges in their lives and have had to overcome those challenges.
Mm.
So, and that's the base of their material. And so I think that, no, he wasn't funny all the time. But the really interesting thing is he would try material out on me and he'd go, well, what do you think about this?
Yep.
And I go, and I would always look at it from, you know, how would an audience suit it?
You would have been a great sounding board.
I know, but except for he'd go, yeah, you don't think that's funny. You only think your jokes are funny.
All right.
Because I would tell a joke
and
if I told him, I would end up like absolutely wetting myself and thinking that it was hilarious. And he would just look at me and go, that's not funny.
So you didn't give him any content to work with?
Oh, I gave him the best content to work with. So we went on to have two children. Mm-hmm. So Madeline, who is now 21, my beautiful girl, and Spencer, who is 17, nearly 18. Through my birth, or through the birth of Madeline, David collected material all the way through. Even now, it's still quite legendary.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, me giving birth and him looking at it like his favourite pub was about to burn down. We would do shows because we started to promote comedy, and David would do a lot of one-man shows, and people would realise that he and I were connected. And on the way out, women would just look at me and go, really? Mm. Do you worry about him actually talking about your birth on, or your daughter's birth on stage? And it didn't, you know, because that was part of the experience. And that's very much what comedy is about. It's about being able to convey experience and getting people to feel those experiences. Mm. And certainly he did that very well.
Mm.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, it's that kind of connection, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when you, if you sort of relate to it, you sort of go, oh, God, yes, I was there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. I don't think I want to remember that moment, but we've all been there.
That's right. And I think the thing, I guess, from early days, which was really evident for me, is that, you know, there is a lot of health benefits to laughter. And you know, I remember the first time I ever saw stand-up, which was before I met Dave, and I just remember walking out going, oh, feel so enlightened, and you know, it just was such an amazing feeling. And so to be part of that that industry was just phenomenal.
And he introduced that to you.
He did. That was definitely his gift. I still have long-lasting relationships in the comedy fraternity from that, from, you know, that started at that time.
Amazing. You're still maintaining that community, aren't you?
So do you feel that he kind of taught you how to laugh? Do you know what I mean? Because obviously, like you said, your childhood was very much about, wasn't it, you know, that discipline and
commitment
and all that sort of thing, you know, and timings and, you know.
Routine, boring.
All those things that, again, it's quite challenging.
Yes, he taught me a lot of things. One of the things that he taught me was to laugh. He taught me how to love. And he also taught me about, he had actually grown up in Doveton as an immigrant.
Okay.
He was actually born in Scotland to an Australian father and a Scottish mother, and they immigrated over from Scotland. And so he was in Doveton. He was actually, during one part of his time, was actually part of the Doveton skinheads.
We won't hold that against him.
No. But I think
what was required to be in the Doveton skinheads. Like, what did you have to do?
Well, I think he had to wear a connie. I think he had to have a very short hair and a tail. But I think he had to be rebellious.
Yes.
And he certainly was.
Yeah.
And I think he spent most of his time growing up in Doveton trying to get out of Doveton.
Mm.
So that was something that was really, up until, you know, his final days, that was something that was definitely that spirit of... Mm. Rising above that was really important. And, you know, David was one of seven children. He was the oldest the male. Sorry, he was the oldest male out of the seven children. So there's five sisters who are all very dynamic, I might add. But, you know, he really felt his father left home when he was about 11 or 12, and he assumed that responsibility for a while. So it was very hard to assume responsibility and be rebellious at the same time. So it was quite conflicted by that. It was a tough upbringing. And so he learned a lot of things from that. And I think that's what he imparted on me, and certainly on our children as well. That, you know, that spirit of you being able to rise above things.
Which ends up being very important now.
Very important.
For the kids and for you.
Absolutely. So, but, you know, it was a great time, and you know, we did a lot in the comedy fraternity. We worked with a lot of people. David also wrote for Russell Gilbert, for example. You know, he worked with all the major headliners. And then actually became, you know, quite well regarded for his comedy on stage.
So as that's paralleling, you're actually setting up with Nicole over ovarian cancer.
Yeah, so what actually happened with that? So my aunt was, my mum's sister was actually diagnosed in 1994 with ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time actually doing a little bit of research and thinking, wow, thank God that's not my mum.
Mm.
And not knowing it ran in families, I think was a really big thing for us.
Yeah.
And my mum had actually had a hysterectomy. And so mum's standard response, because she'd actually gone to a top professor, mum's standard response was, oh, that's all been taken care of. I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah.
So when 4 years later, she was having these symptoms and they actually sent her for a scan, they said, oh, we believe that she has ovarian cancer. She has an ovarian tumour. And we just went, well, hang on a minute. No, because she's had a hysterectomy. She doesn't have ovaries. What are you talking about? And in fact, the professor had actually left her ovaries behind, which was is yes, quite common.
Very common, yeah, for sure.
So mum could actually go through a natural menopause.
Mm-hmm.
But mum didn't understand the anatomy. She didn't understand that she'd actually had bits and pieces left behind. So that was actually really confronting to find out that she, you know, she could have potentially had ovarian cancer. So she actually, with ovarian cancer, you're conclusively diagnosed at surgery. So they can have a fair idea that there's a tumour, but they don't know whether it's moved outside of the ovaries, it's contained. If it's contained, it's pretty easier to take the ovary and the fallopian tube out and, you know, and minimal treatment afterwards.
Yes.
But when mum was operated on, they actually found that she had a very large tumour and it had actually spread outside of the ovaries and into the abdomen. So she was actually diagnosed at stage 3, ovarian cancer. Her sister had been diagnosed at stage 4.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a completely different, I mean, obviously we were devastated. Our mum was our rock.
Yeah.
It still makes me upset thinking about it.
Yeah.
And so we actually had to... we actually had to fight to find ways that we could make her life better while she was with us.
Wow.
And certainly I know Professor Michael Quinn at the Royal Women's Hospital, who is has become a very close friend of mine. We would turn up for mum's appointments and he would have to go and get chairs because the whole family would turn up, which is quite unusual. You know, normally women turn up with their husband and that's it. But all of Gary and Nicole and I would all want to be there as well. So, yeah, it was a very difficult time. Mum was, I guess, different in that she had made peace with the fact that she actually had the diagnosis and that she probably wouldn't survive.
Yeah.
Her and her sister were very close because obviously they were going through something similar.
Yeah.
But whereas Aunty Dawn was quite defiant, Mum was more accepting of her fate.
Mm-hmm.
And Mum lasted 2 years and 10 months from diagnosis. My aunt was, I think, 10 years and 11 months. So the contrast was actually quite unique. But what the medical team was saying to us was initially that they thought that it was a coincidence that Mum and her sister both had the disease.
Okay.
My mum never believed that. And around about that time it was thought, because it was not as technically advanced as what it is now, and they thought that it was about 4% of women had hereditary cancer. We now know it's about 18%, so it's completely different. But Mum was a larger woman. She never smoked. She never drank. And my aunt was, you know, quite slim, smoked packet of cigarettes a day and would have an occasional drink. So they were completely different lifestyles. So it had to, in Mum's mind, it had to be genetic.
Yeah.
And in those days, to actually have a DNA test or what they call a BRCA test, which is, and most of your listeners would know about Angelina Jolie having the BRCA2 gene, which is what mum was being tested for. And to actually have that test was quite expensive.
Mm.
And so they said, oh, look, we think it's a coincidence, therefore we're not going to test your blood. So mum, in her foresight, actually put blood away for it to be tested in the future.
Fantastic.
Yeah, we were extremely... I mean, it was totally mum's legacy.
Mm.
We were extremely lucky that we were then... mum passed away. She went in with pains in the stomach and it was a clot, and she actually passed from that clot.
Right.
Unfortunately, I didn't make it in to say goodbye to her, but I think she waited for me when I arrived so I could say goodbye. And so that whole process was very sad, and we had to rebuild and you know, how do you pick up the pieces when you've lost part of your soul?
Yeah, it's very traumatic.
Oh, you know, your mother, you come from your mother. So that took a long time for me to come to some sort of understanding. But 9 months after she actually passed away, the medical team actually told us that they would test the blood to see whether there was a BRCA gene.
Yeah.
And they did come back and say that there was a BRCA2 gene.
Mm.
So we then knew why mum and her sister both had had ovarian cancer, which was really powerful. I mean, it was powerful to know that.
Yeah, knowledge is power for sure.
Absolutely. Mm. So, and then we were able to, our whole family were able to have testing from that. And I was found to also have the BRCA2 gene.
Right.
But I do find that empowering to know, to have that knowledge and to know. And I've never I've spoken to a lot of women with regards to BRCA testing, and I've never felt that it's not the right thing to do, because I think that, you know, if you do know that there are things that you can do to change the future. For sure.
So if people are concerned out there, how do they get this test? What do they do?
The symptoms of ovarian cancer are abdominal or pelvic pain, increased size of abdomen and persistent bloating, which is not normal for the woman, frequent urination, you're suddenly running to the toilet all the time, feeling full but not being able to eat much food.
Right.
I mean, and look, they're normal conditions for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But what we're saying is, if it's suddenly happens to a woman and it is not the normal, then they should certainly go to their doctors and actually ask, could it be ovarian cancer? The problem is that ovarian cancer is actually quite a rare, it is considered rare.
Yes.
It's not common. And so what will happen is, and why most women are actually misdiagnosed before being correctly diagnosed, is that doctors will do other diagnostic tests or think they're more benign conditions before actually going into the correct diagnostic testing.
Wow. Okay.
But yeah, it's really important to actually document the symptoms that you're having, so you can, and the frequency, so you can actually take it to your GP with the specific question, could this be ovarian cancer?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in 2001, myself and Nicole, my sister, joined three other people to found Ovarian Cancer Australia, or what is now known as Ovarian Cancer Australia, as a consumer organisation, because there was no information in the public realm about about the disease.
Yeah.
And I can remember the first time we ever went to a medical symposium. We had a gentleman who was the head of the Cancer Council Australia actually come up to us, and we were so excited. We're like, wow, this is what we're going to do. And he was so negative. And he actually said, well, no, I don't think you should release the symptoms of ovarian cancer, because every woman will think she's got it. You know, we were...
You were really forward-thinking.
gobsmacked that he would even suggest that we should.
Because, like you said, knowledge is power. You know?
Absolutely.
When we think about our daughters, we want some sort of system set up for them that it's just a part of growing up is to get themselves checked.
But I think it was also doubting that women had the intelligence to be able to look after themselves and ask the appropriate questions and have that appropriate knowledge. And I have to tell you that in the first 2 years of founding Ovarian Cancer, that really, his attitude really drove us to the positive.
Mm. Well, what a wonderful legacy you've left, you know. Mm. It's amazing.
It is.
Yeah. So what's the next song?
So let's play Ray of Light, Madonna. You chose this. Was there something particular that you liked about this song?
Yeah, Dave and I quite liked this album of Madonna's. It's probably a bit daggy now.
But we still like it.
Yeah, I just think that it was light and it was happy and it was fun and it just, you know, it was different.
Ray of Light, Madonna. You're listening to 98.7 Your Story Counts with Nan and Simone, and we have in the studio the very inspirational Karen Livingstone, the Well Activist Award, awarded advocate and health entrepreneur.
Yeah. Mm. And you know what? We've loved listening to you, you know, over the last sort of 45 minutes about your incredible story. But, you know, you're good at talking about everyone else.
I know.
And we want to know about you. So we're going to hand it over because we really want to hear, you know, well, what's your story in all this?
Well, I guess what is probably missing in terms of the piece is that in January 2009 I was conclusively diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis, which is something that I've not talked about in the media before. So I'm giving you guys
the first scoop.
I prefer not to have that scoop, but anyway.
Well, look, I think it's, you know, I made the choice at the time not to actually take pharmaceutical medication that was offered to me. I sit on a clinical trials board in Australia, New Zealand, and certainly I'm not against pharmaceutical drugs, but I'm about integrative health. And I'm not saying that I won't go down the line of pharmaceutical drugs for me with regards to the MS, but at this point in time I'm not using pharmaceutical medication. I've decided to do it naturally. And so that was in January 2009, and in that same year, in April 2009, my husband, Dave Grant, was actually diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, which has a 7% survival rate, which is the worst.
So that was in the same year.
It was 4 months after my diagnosis with MS.
Wow.
So it was, you know, it was the most horrible year that you could ever imagine on record. And certainly, you know, David always did things untraditionally. So he decided that he wanted to go absolutely natural because the medical fraternity couldn't help him. So we ended up in the alternative clinics in Mexico. The comedy fraternity did some fundraisers for us, and with that money David decided that's what he wanted to do. And that was the first time I actually heard of glutathione. With most people they say, glute or what? But glutathione we knew that it was really important, and we knew we had to try to find a source of it.
So that's an antioxidant, isn't it?
It is an antioxidant, so glutathione is the master antioxidant that's already in your body.
It's the mother of all antioxidants.
It is, and it's actually the cell defence. So it actually is your inbuilt body's defence system. And certainly we were taking oral glutathione, which unfortunately gets compromised in the gut, so not much of it was actually going through into the cell. Unfortunately, Dave passed away after 10 months from diagnosis. It was a pretty horrific time, particularly for our children, who my daughter was 14 and a half and my son was 10 and a half. And it was a very complex journey with regards to their grief. And so I guess in the March after David had died, I was talking to one of my best friends, one of my rocks, Sue, and she actually said to me, she was a medical professional. She helped me nurse David. She said, I've heard you talk about glutathione, and what do you know? And I said, I know lots. Why? Mm. She said, well, there's this product. And so at that time I was stressed. I now found myself to be a single parent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Financially, I had to find a way to
earn money.
Earn money, keep it all together.
Be dad and absolutely. With a diagnosis for MS.
Yeah. And wow. So I was quite stressed. And so I started on this product, which is actually provides the building blocks to glutathione. Mm. So it doesn't get compromised in the gut and it goes straight into the cell. Mm-hmm. And I have to say within 2 weeks I felt amazingly different and better. And I've been able to maintain my health through using glutathione, but also through having my DNA analysed through Smart DNA. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was another major experience for me in terms of knowledge. Mm. I found out why I actually was more susceptible to cancer and also to MS. Mm. I have poor methylation.
Uh-huh.
But that to me, knowledge is powerful. And absolutely. So I've been able to counter what my genes have, the blueprint of my genes. I've that's changed right. my destiny by changing my behaviour and changing the way that I do things in terms of my health, and my nutrition is a major factor. And I've been able to keep well.
Yes.
I'm not saying that I'm 100% clear of my MS. I do have a little bit of neuropathy in my hand, but I'm well 8 years on, and
massive congratulations. That's absolutely incredible.
I am so thankful for that. It really means a lot to me. The two things, definitely glutathione, boosting my glutathione levels, and also having my DNA analysed by Smart DNA.
Mm. Do you think also the gene that you have that's a positive gene is that seeker in you? You know what I mean? The searcher, the part of you that says...
A quest for knowledge? Yeah. Absolutely. I think I've always been like that. Mm. And I think when you do actually have... you do have your nutritional genomics done, you do understand why you do things a little bit more. Mm. To me, it's like a light bulb moment.
That's right.
And it actually... It answers a lot of some things you know instinctively, but it answers a lot of, things that you've wondered.
It takes out the guesswork.
It absolutely takes out the guesswork. Mm. It's so invaluable. Mm. And you know what? And I know I see this with my board in Sydney, which is a gynecological cancer clinical trials group. It's about personalised medicine.
Yeah, it's the future.
It is the future. It is here. Mm. And we really need to embrace it more, I think. And I know that, you know, in terms of treatment and medical interventions, they're now starting to take on more information so that women... in particular with gynecological cancer, can actually be treated personally, not one size fits all. And it is the moment that it is here, and we really do need to embrace it more.
Do you know what I love about you? And this is, you know, we're so lucky to be talking to you, and it is that person where, you know, I know a lot of people have been diagnosed with MS, but it's, my mum was actually diagnosed when I was in year 9 or something. And, she doesn't quite know how, she found a way. But, you know, it's about the fact that you had this, this energy that's this quest, this trailblazer that now will allow, even by talking to people out there today, give them some ideas, you know, which is a little bit faster route than what you've gone through.
Yeah, you're like a roadmap for some of these people.
I think the thing is that... once you start on a farm, and this was why I made the decision not to go down that track, once you start on a pharmaceutical regimen, it's almost like you're on a roundabout and you can't get off because it doesn't actually get to the root cause.
Yeah.
And to me it was just, it made much more sense to get to the root cause, which I did.
Than just the Band-Aid.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. And so I think and I hope that your listeners will perhaps feel more confident to try different things.
Mm.
And and to know that there's a different way. And integrative health, I think, is the future as well. Mm. So personalised medicine, integrative health. I mean, I think it's critical that, you know, we just don't go to the doctor and expect that they're going to have all the answers, because they don't. And certainly that's what I strongly believe.
It's so empowering, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, cancer can feel so disempowering. We're all walking around feeling like, you know, we're walking time bombs, you know, never knowing, you know, whether it's going to be us or not.
Yeah.
And of course, as we as you get older, you meet more and more people who are experiencing this, which makes you think. But like you say, to go down this path and really be able to understand your own DNA, understand the potential in it, but also the strengths in it, and have an opportunity of choice, is quite phenomenal.
And I think that that's very much about, I've just launched my new business, which is called The Well Activist. And that's very much about going out and talking to groups of people and letting them know that there is a different way, and just sharing my experience, sharing the knowledge of smart DNA and nutritional genomics and what the benefits are from actually undertaking that. And also glutathione is another major piece.
I take it.
You take it?
Yes.
Yes. Well done, Simone. And you know it's anti-aging. Yeah. So you get older...
That's it. We're all having it.
Absolutely. Well, and this makes sense, because as you get older, you produce... within your body, you produce less glutathione. So we know that people get are more inclined to get ill as they get older. And that is because their cell defence is actually breaking down. So it makes sense to actually boost up your glutathione levels so that your body your body intuitively knows what to do. And you're just giving it the ingredients support to be able to do it. Absolutely. Totally. So the Well Activist is very much about going out and telling people about learning about their DNA and also the benefits of glutathione. And we're actually down here at Mount Eliza Country Club on the 13th of July. And we're doing a presentation. So,
because I love listening to you tell your story when you do these talks, because I've come to one of your talks before, and it's very inspiring to come to speak from your heart and your own personal experience. It's very powerful.
I think it is powerful, and I think, you know, it's because people can look inside themselves and can relate.
Connect,
yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, for me moving forward, I've actually found my spirit and I've found my place in the world. I've always believed that founding Ovarian Cancer and running the organisation Ovarian Cancer Australia was not all that I had to give. So for me, it's very much about being able to go out and promote awareness about different things. I'm also part of a Pancreatic Cancer Alliance. I consult to Cancer Australia. I sit on this board for ANSGOG. So all of those things are really important as well. But, you know, I guess in my own soul, it's this pathway of being able to talk to people individually and letting them know. So the future is actually really bright. I'm really looking forward to it.
So what do you do to relax? Do you actually have a day off? That's the million-dollar question.
Do you know what my – when you say that, I guess my big thing is I love Paris. Paris is my place.
Yeah, she likes the Parisian men.
I do. I do. I have quite a few friends over there now, and I've developed that. But to me, walking through Paris, it just resonates in my soul, and that's my escape, and that's my place. And I took myself there before my 50th and after my 50th, and I hope to one day go over there and actually live for a little period of time. That would be my hope.
Well, you have to do a roadshow over there, perhaps.
I would love to do a roadshow over there. And if you can help me organise that, that would be awesome. But look, I think personally that I'm excited about the future.
Yeah, well, what an inspirational story.
Absolutely wonderful story. Thank you so much for hanging out with us, and your story counts. You know, and again, we would love to hear the next chapter. As the Well Activist. Now, obviously, people can get hold of you through Facebook. Is that right?
Yeah. So I've just, as of overnight, launched my Facebook page, which is called The Well Activist. And I invite people to come and join me there. They can also join me on Twitter as The Well Activist or on Instagram as The Well Activist. But I'm looking forward to connecting, and I'm happy to share my experience with people if they contact me.
Fantastic. And again, you're speaking on...
I am. I'm part of myself and Sue Barron. Sharon will be appearing Thursday the 13th of July at Mount Eliza Country Club, and we'll be talking DNA and glutathione.
Well, so it's the 13th of July, is it?
Yes. Yeah. We'll be there.
We'll be there. We'll pop in.
Yay!
What time does it start?
So the doors open at 7 o'clock and we'll start at 7:30.
Mm. 7 o'clock, 7:30.
Yeah.
All right. Time for a cheeky little drink beforehand.
That's right.
Hey? Exactly. And then we'll all pile in there. Well, thank you again.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's just been fantastic. Great. Well, thanks, Simone, as always.
Yes.
Always great hanging out with you.
Yeah, we'll see
and
you next time.
Next week we have the wonderful Liz McKenzie,
an
incredible story. And also Max On's going to pop in and show us her new song.
Wow.
So pretty exciting stuff.